Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. We have another great show for you today. We've got a really interesting guest who's written a book about his experiences with in law enforcement and how it related to his post-traumatic stress disorder, something that we talk about often on this program. If you haven't checked out my Facebook page, please do so at Randy Sutton Public Figure on Facebook. And before we go to the interview room, let's take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
This week has changed America. This week saw the worst mass shooting in the history of our country. And it happened right here in my hometown of Las Vegas. I've been heavily involved in reporting about this, words fail me, and you know that doesn't happen very often. This tragic madness that took the lives of almost 60 people and injured more than 500. I was home watching a little television, and I got a phone call from the TV station that I sometimes advise about and consult about law enforcement topics. And they asked me if I could come in immediately because of the mass shooting on the Strip. I hadn't heard about it. So I ran into the station and I stayed there for the next 6 hours watching as image after image took place and the devastation, the bodies, the panic, the absolute incredible vision of pain and suffering that greeted me. It's almost impossible to conceive of how one human being, one sick, twisted human being, could be capable of such a horrendous act. But that's what happened. One man. Now, the investigation, of course, is in progress. But what we do know at this time is that the 64-year-old man with no significant criminal history whatsoever, the guy who was apparently a millionaire, had nothing in his past that we know of at this point that would point to anything that would register on the scale to say, hey, you know what, this is a guy that needs to be watched. He spent 3 days in the rented room at the Mandalay Bay. During that time, he smuggled in approximately 19 firearms and a huge amount of ammunition. And then he waited. Apparently he knew that there was going to be a major country music festival directly across the street from where his room was. This wasn't a coincidence. He planned this out for God knows how long. How he got these weapons into his room is a matter of great interest. Did he smuggle them into golf bags? Did he break them down? And did he have that skill level that he could disassemble those firearms and put them in a suitcase? But however he got them in, he got them in. And then he waited for the right moment. He waited for the last song of the concert, the one with the biggest name star. There were approximately 30,000 people packed into this small area. And it was about 500 yards from where his window was, He was on 32nd floor. He waited until the country music star was performing the last song, and he brought up a bunch of veterans up to the stage for a song that honored them. And that's when it happened. This creature had a sledgehammer, and he smashed out the windows of the suite that he was in. And then he rained down hell. He fired thousands of rounds of ammunition. He had his weapons modified to full automatic. One of the weapons that I saw had a tripod and a scope. And in the cell phone videos that were taken, you can hear the rapid fire, fully automatic firepower unleashing the devastating fusillade into that helpless crowd. The death toll is immense. Almost 60 people at this point probably will rise. The number of victims who were injured by gunfire and also by injuries occurred during the escape numbers more than 500. It is the deadliest shooting in American history. Why? That's something we just don't know. And as devastating as this is, there's some amount of something that I can only refer to as light that emanates from this. And that is the courage, that is the compassion that was shown by so many people, the bravery that was shown by the police, the competence that was shown by law enforcement and first responders. It was something that should be honored. Several police officers lost their lives during this event. A Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department patrol officer who was attending the concert, and he was killed. You can go to the end of this show and listen to his information at the end of watch. Another Metropolitan Police officer was shot in the neck and is in critical condition. And then there were off-duty police officers from other jurisdictions. Now, one of the miracles that happened here is, first of all, the police response was incredible. As this subject was shooting his automatic weapons down into the crowd, raining just incredible amounts of firepower, off-duty and on-duty police officers responded and located the suspect. They found, and you could see and hear the commands being given by supervisors who formed teams to deal with an active shooter, just as they had been trained to do. They found the subject. They found him on the 32nd floor. The subject fired out of the, through the walls of the hotel room. He struck a security officer. The teams called for SWAT unit, which of course had already been notified about this event. And the SWAT team made a dynamic entry. They used a breaching tool, an explosive device to blow off the door, fully expecting to deal with the subject. Now think of the bravery that it takes to go into that room knowing there's a subject armed with a fully automatic weapon. And no matter how much safety equipment you have on, there's probably no way you're going to walk through that door and not face serious injury or death. But they were ready. Now, unfortunately, the suspect took the coward's way out and shot himself, killed himself. I say unfortunately because I think the true justice here would have been if the Metro SWAT team ended his miserable existence. But it really shows his cowardice. He was a big man, wasn't he? When he was isolated in a room with high-powered firearms that he could rain down and murder helpless women, children, men. But he didn't have the guts to face the police. I think it says something. So the law enforcement response is something that we as Americans should be proud of. They showed amazing courage and competence. They literally ran to the sound of gunfire, as they have been doing for years. So when the very next day there was a football game and a couple of Kansas City Chiefs players once again refused to stand for the national anthem in their protest of police, it literally made me ill. The absolute heartlessness of these players, the amazing lack of any type of morality as they make this public display of their political beliefs is simply astounding. How Americans can even bear to watch these entitled punks is something I just don't understand. No matter what the police do, it's not good enough. No matter how many lives they save, it's not good enough for these people. But one thing I want to bring up that is really, really important in this dark, dark tale is the response by the people who were victimized here. Thousands and thousands of people, you know, literally a flight for their life, running away, trying to save their own life, as bodies are falling right next to them, as their loved ones are dying right next to them, as bullets are ripping into the bodies of people that they know and people that they don't know, remarkable thing happened. People began covering other people's bodies with their own. People began dragging others to safety instead of running for their own lives. Citizens who happened to be driving by got involved. You know, when you're talking about those kind of casualties, the ambulances couldn't even get into the scene fast enough, and people that are driving by literally loaded up their cars with the wounded and transported themselves to the hospitals. Think about that. Think of what humanity that shows. The stories of courage of many in the crowd. Some were law enforcement officers who were off duty. Some were veterans. There was a large amount of veterans at this country concert. Others were firefighters who were off duty. And then there were just plain citizens. People that cared enough to get involved, to show intense bravery, literally, as they faced their own deaths. We'll never know how many people died while saving others. And you can bet there's a bunch of them. But I think that for the next generation, the stories of courage and compassion are going to be told in the living rooms and dens of people all over this country, as well as tales of tragedy and the horrible waste of life. It's at times like these when Americans show the best part of themselves, even as the worst part of humanity is also demonstrated. I think what we need to do is concentrate on how the goodness, the kindness, the compassion, the courage of Americans must never be defeated by evil, must never be overlooked because of the cruelty of one man or one group of people. It's not who we are as Americans. So even in this darkness, there is light. It's still just a couple days after this event as I talk about it. I've talked to a number of officers who were there, and one thing I found, and it doesn't surprise me, is how these police officers didn't hesitate one second. In fact, many of them had not even been called in to work, but they heard about it. They heard it on television. Without even asking, they came to the scene. They engaged. Some just ran right into the hotel even before the shooting had ended. That shows you what these men and women are made of. It shows you that through all of this horrendous social time that is taking place, where police officers are being vilified by the media and by celebrities and sports figures and agenda-driven politicians, they will never step down from their duties. They will never shirk the people that they have sworn to serve. They will always run towards the sound of the gunfire. That's what the American cop is made of. And that's my view from the blue. If you have security needs, that is, if your company needs security, we all need security, right? But if your company needs security or your business, the person you want to talk to is Doug Carter of JSD Protective Services. That's JSDProtectiveServices.com. Go check out their website. Now, I'm really impressed with their operation. I've met their folks. I've met Doug. And his commitment to the top training for these security officers is pretty impressive. These men and women that work for him are consummate security professionals, and they've got armed security. They do pretty much everything in the realm of security, which includes bodyguarding, private investigation, and they're all over the United States. So check them out, JSD Protective Services. Tell them Randy sent you.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep, but it doesn't have to be that way. there haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is Dustin Reicher. Dustin is a retired deputy sheriff from the Anoka County Sheriff's Office in Minnesota. And we're going to talk today about his experiences being involved in an officer-involved shooting and the aftermath of that incident. Dustin, thanks so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
It is my pleasure and honor.
Dustin, tell us a little bit about your law enforcement career and what brought it to an end.
You know, I probably a total of 10 years in law enforcement, you know, starting out with as a reserve, unlicensed. In Minnesota, we only have a couple agencies that you can get licensed on. So eventually I got part-time licensed and did some lakes and trail patrol with Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, which I focused more on the park side for the criminal side, and maneuvered my way into Anoka County, and I was there for 7 years total, almost.
Okay, 7 years total with the Anoka County. How big a department is that?
You know, right now, it's I don't know the numbers now. It's been hopping. In my time, just after the 7 years, my seniority jumped so crazy. It was nuts. Patrol division, I want to say, was right around size of 25 or so total deputies. And now I love my department, but I can drive by them and have no clue who's behind the wheel of a car anymore.
Right. But when you were there, there were about 25 road deputies?
Yeah, I want to say it was right around 25 to 28, somewhere around there for road deputies.
Okay. Now, describe the area. How big was the county? Was it rural or was it urban?
You know, Anoka County is kind of interesting. We're just north of Minneapolis-St. Paul, that Ramsey and Hennepin counties, and so we're a really large county. I don't know the actual demographics for population, but it's a big county, and we actually are north of both of them, mostly rural. We have our areas on the south side or the south end of the county, but me being a city boy from North Minneapolis and then a suburban boy, it was definitely a culture shock coming out to the types of calls that we got to deal with out here in comparison.
You mean coming out to the boondocks? Is that what you're saying?
When I was driving by Bunker Park, I kept asking myself for the final interview, why am I coming out here? I'm not sure if this is for me or not. I was wrong, but that's what I thought.
Okay, so you joined the sheriff's department. You worked the streets as a patrol officer?
Yeah, for most of my time, I worked as a patrol officer. I did a stint as a detective on the Anoka-Hennepin Violent Crimes and Drug Task Force. And then I worked as a drug recognition expert, which is part of the patrol duties overall.
During that time, you had a critical incident. Describe what happened.
We got one night we were over heavily staffed, and we had a new deputy on, Samantha Cruz, who had reached out to me, and she says, "We have a lot of extra patrol. Would you mind showing me like meth labs and how to do, you know, ripping cars and things like that?" So I was pretty excited. Unfortunately, we never have that much patrol staff on, and so some of the guys took the night off, called in sick, which more than okay with. And so Sam and I found ourselves in Andover, the city of Andover, which is our most suburban city that we patrol. The city I don't like the most, because nothing exciting ever happens in Andover, which I regret ever saying. And we got on a call one night where it was loud music, and I was just backing her up. It's the only street, I would say, in Andover that we had concerns about people fighting officers, and I decided to go. It was loud music. Thursday night, no big deal, no cars in the driveway, and strangely enough, it was the Bee Gees that was playing from the house.
That's
though.
A good memory for you.
Yes, not staying alive, but it was definitely, I can picture it as I say it.
Okay, so you were answering a call. You were going to back her up.
Yep, backing her up, and we approached. She talked to the neighbors who were complaining. It was about 2:30 in the morning, and we walked to the door, and has nothing for me to really do. This is her thing. And I was just watching in the picture window. It's a full moonlit out night. And I just said, hey, dark living room. Looks like there's a light on in a back room. Might be a kitchen. I see a shadow. Looks like somebody's coming. Oh, they turned back and went back into the kitchen. And then as they turned around, I could see what was very distinctly a large handgun in his hand. And I yelled, as I ducked down, I started to say, holy crap, he's got a gun. And she did the right thing. I was fresh out of training and just yelled gun. And then we went for what we thought would be cover. And, you know, one of the things I didn't note there is, you know, my partner was 2 days on her own. So even though she was a friend of mine, had been with the department for 2 years, she just had started on patrol. So as we went to the side, we were in a duplex, realized that the other end of the duplex is a little farther than I'm going to run. My general rule is if I'm going to get shot, it's not going to be in the back. And as we sat there and he started opening the door, we start yelling, me, low voice, her, higher pitched voice, and whole time. Of course, I'm thinking, it's not going to happen. And as he starts to open the storm door, I realize that if he starts throwing rounds at us, he's going to hit us both. So I just took a step away to kind of separate the both of us. And by doing so, I was officially committed and nearly face-to-face with him. So from a distance of 8 feet, eventually, when he pointed the gun at me and he raised it to my eyes and we exchanged bullets. And thank goodness I lived, and unfortunately he did not.
He opened the door. He targeted you.
Yeah, when he opened the door, you know, the whole time I'm thinking, I don't know if any of us, especially in an area like this, ever think that a shooting like this is going to happen, and especially on a call like this. And as I realized I was committed, I started angling around. There's nowhere to run for cover. The trees are tiny, and so you got to face it head on. There's nothing you can do. And so I wanted to get face to face to actually see him at that point. And as he raised that gun to my chest, he's elevated position a couple steps up, and we're about 5 to 8 feet away. And at that point, you know, honestly, I was committed. I'm pulling my trigger. And I hadn't done it yet, but I knew that at that point, and by the time I was able to get my gun leveled fully and pulling the trigger, he actually had it pointed between my eyes. So I pulled twice.
Did you get any rounds off?
At that point, no. And not that I think I'm any big bad gun shooter. I just think as a half a second trigger pull. I pulled twice. My gun only went off once. We think I just didn't recharge the trigger. I don't know. And I saw it hit him. I knew it hit him. I saw him cower. And as I ran from the only cover I could see, which was a car, I flashlighted. I did a tactical flashlight through the window. And turns out he's an expert marksman, and he tracked me after taking a lethal round. And he did a double tap on me and was able to drop me.
He took a position of cover. And then shot back at you?
More specifically, I hit him through the storm door. It actually hit the frame, the center frame of the storm door. And it's not tooting my horn. It just was literally nearly a dead center shot. And I saw him cower back almost out of view because he's still in his living room. And so as I ran to the car straight across his picture window, thinking-wise, I'll keep my flashlight up on my handgun and I'll you know, flash it through the window thinking that I could see him. And what I hadn't thought of is that gave him a target to track on me.
Right.
And that's how he shot me through the picture window twice.
Where did he hit you?
First round, upper right humerus, so that upper area where your bicep is. And that one got me good. It took about half to three-quarter inch of my bone just exploded. And I remember watching the gun just go flying like Matrix. My whole body just spun in slow motion. And by the time I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, I just got shot before the word shot could come to mind. The second round hit me into what I thought was my leg. But how do I explain this? It hit me 1/8 of an inch above my best friend, if you know what I'm saying. And that one dropped me big time.
So you suffered two major gunshot wounds. Where was your partner?
She was still in her position where she was at. No, she did not. And I want to make sure that I clarify so everybody knows. I made sure I clarified with my partners. You know, we can always go back, but we fast forward. Against being ordered by the sheriff, she still came to the hospital to see me. And I asked everybody to leave the room. And I just said, all right, tell me what happened. and she ran down her side of things, and she couldn't see him. Once I pulled the trigger, she said he dropped back, and she couldn't see him at all.
Right, right. I can imagine.
100% accept her answer.
Right, of course, of course. So what happened after you were hit?
You know, I dropped, made a horrible sound, as Sam reminds me at times. And you go into tactical mode or, living mode. Forget tactical mode. You know, survival mode. I'm 5 feet from the window. I know I hit him. He dropped me anyways. Is he going to shoot me again? Where the hell is my gun? That's really the first thing I started looking for. And as I tried to move my arm, I could see that the bone was completely separated, so I knew it was broken. Certified as an EMT prior to that, so I kind of went in that mode, started moving my fingers, could tell that they were still working, tried to call out on the radio. I mean, this is all happening in super high speed, but for me, it was really, really slow-mo. And I wanted to let them know that I got hit. I hear her calling out, 1088 officer down. And after I realized I wasn't going to be able to move, I tried to crawl, and I crawled what I think is 5 to 8 feet, but I think it was only a couple feet. And I just... That double tap rule where they say it shocks your body, I'll stand a test of that because my body just said I'm done. And unfortunately, I laid there for a little while longer playing dead, hoping that I wasn't bleeding to death because I thought it had gotten me in my right femoral artery. That's where I felt it. So I literally thought I was bleeding to death. And interesting, I don't know what they do in other states, but one of my instructors in the skills, Bob Penny was his name, and I remember I hate running, and he made us run yelling, if I'm shot, I will survive. If I'm stabbed, I will survive. And Randy, I got to tell you, I sat there quietly telling myself as I slowed my breathing, if I'm shot, I will survive. If I'm shot, and I really believe that helped calm things. Even though physically, we find out later, I wasn't going to die. I literally thought at that moment, I was going to bleed to death.
Of course. How did the rescue take place, and then what happened with the suspect?
You know, the cavalry came. Sam, my partner, Deputy Cruz, did a great job, even based on the circumstances. And anybody who's listening, just keep in mind, you know, 2 days on your own, this isn't something we can train for. This is something that just happens in experience. And she backed up a little bit towards a more tactical position towards the other end of the duplex, was calling out to me. I tried to call out on the radio one more time and just threw my radio because I got mad because I couldn't get out. And she just talked to me. And when we later find out that she thought I was dead, I give her kudos for staying there talking to someone that she was absolutely sure was dead. And shortly after the cavalry came, I could hear people doing a tactical plan with my sergeant. I have zero issue with that. And then Sergeant Scotty Nolan from Anoka PD just came running up, forgetting all tactical rules, tapped me on the shoulder. Hey, Dustin, Scotty Nolan, do you know who I am? And Scotty is a great guy, but a little nutty. So if you had to have somebody ignoring the rules and be the first one to you, he's the guy. Okay. He really is the guy.
We all know people like that, don't we?
Yeah, all the cops listening are chuckling right now. You know that guy. And he just retired recently himself. So I can say that and be confident. But, yeah, he came up, Officer Kiesling, a couple other sergeants, Coon Rapids, I mean, just what felt like hundreds of cars calling out over the radio that they were coming. And they came and they scooped me, and it was a horribly painful experience because obviously once Scotty got there, I just told him what's happening, and he sat on me and he pointed the gun at the window, and then the other guys came and they built a wall, and I can tell especially to the cops listening, man, it's nothing like looking up at a bunch of blue, brown, and even maroon-wearing butts pants and thinking to yourself, this is the greatest sight I could see. And it wasn't about anything sexual. It was because they literally formed a human wall in less than 10 feet from where they know a guy just shot me through. And so just the heroism that was involved there was just nuts. And when they tried to roll me on my broken arm, I told them I was having none of that, and from that point forward, they eventually got me on there and got me to the ambulance. And I had a few times where I was arguing with ambulance drivers and flight nurses on a helicopter and all that. But I went back and apologized to them later.
What happened with the suspect?
I want to say it was 2 hours, could have been 4 hours. The SWAT team came, relieved everybody, and after a bunch of calling in, they threw some flashbangs in. And eventually they were to go in and find out that he was hit in the lung. Part I didn't include is that while I was laying there on the ground, the dispatch called out over the radio saying that somebody was calling from inside the address saying they had been shot and that they were dying. That was the suspect, and I knew that. Unfortunately for all of my partners, all the dispatchers, everybody thought that was me calling in. And then I listened to the radio later, and it did sound like me. And so they knew likely he was going to be, and they found him, and he had died. I mean, from the gunshot wound to his lung.
So you hit him with a fatal wound. Even though that wound was fatal, it is not like television, is it?
Not even close.
These people often have a lot more fight in them before they expire. And that's one of the things I think that the movies and television have played a great disservice when they depict, people getting shot and suddenly, you know, the fight's over. So when a shooting like this happens, law enforcement officers are often criticized because they continue to fire more than one round, even though it may be a fatal wound, but it takes time. The human body doesn't react to that kind of stimuli all the time.
No, I agree. He was able to fire the two rounds at me and accurately. I mean, it's not like I was running slow. He was able to track the flashlight, and then he went down into the kitchen downstairs. We don't know what he was doing, and there's other guns down there. There was rifle reloaders for bullets. There was the phone, and I think that's when he had grabbed the phone and then went up to the top of the stairs where he eventually had died. It was at the top of the stairs. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of steps that he was able to make, and you're right. TV does not make this look real, not even close. And whenever people talk about just shooting once or twice, I often have to remind them that that's the opportunity for them to still get off the rounds before they die.
Exactly. What was his background?
So I don't know if it was full Navy or Naval. I think he was a Naval reservist. No drugs in his system. The tox screen came back as maybe benzodiazepines, but there was nothing in the confirmation. There's literally nothing. He had been court that day as a witness on a case that involved them suing somebody else, and it sounded like everything had gone well. No complaints in the neighborhood as far as on him, even though that's a troubled neighborhood. He was a landlord, and he ran a pretty tight ship for the landlord, for the renter side of it. I mean, it literally, there's no reason. Lots of guns is about it. And you know, I'm not going to judge anybody for owning a lot of guns. So it's really hard to know, and I think that's what puts this case in a tough place for administrations when they were looking at it, because there was no obvious reason why he would come to the door with a gun and point it at what's obviously a police officer.
Wow. All right, now let's talk about the aftermath.
The aftermath. Anybody who's listening is thinking, wow, that's a lot of stuff. I've learned through some speaking events and writing of my book to organize it. So feel free to stop and ask questions or go back up. Most police officers, and I think public think, believe that, you know, you heal, you get back to the road, and you go forward. And I don't know if there could be anything farther from the truth from most of the cases that I've studied with officers. In my particular case, I was in the hospital for 5 days. There's a lot of little annoyances and frustrations that I think would be natural. And then after I got out of the hospital, all I could think of is I want to be a cop again. Let's get healed. Let's get back to the road. It was pretty tough, you know, the indignities of not being able to be that human being you were for quite a while. I mean, I was, 31, and my mom's helping me shower again. And I don't care what anybody says, that was very upsetting to me that I had to have that, but I was glad she was around. And as we moved forward, you know, I started healing more. I avoided any of the narcotics because being a DRE, I was worried about OxyContin and the addictiveness of it. I just took ibuprofen and did everything they said I needed to do to heal, and I was so excited to get back. Eventually, I got back to light duty and waiting for my day, and I went to the doctor at every chance I could, and eventually they did clear me. Unfortunately, I wasn't allowed to go back to the road because in that 8 months that it took to clear me, my agency made a lot of bad choices, which led to me making some bad choices. I was getting mad. It took them 8 months, I think it was. I was cleared from the grand jury right away. It was a clean shoot. Guy points a gun at a cop. Cop shoots back. guy shoots the cop. There's not a lot to argue, I think, with anybody about that, well, except for maybe the sheriff at the time. His position had been at a sergeant's meeting that he didn't think the guy was going to shoot me. And when we had a later conversation about it, I'm not somebody to hold my comment, and I just said, you had no right to feel that way. As a matter of fact, I told him, if I hadn't pulled the trigger and it worked out, you should have asked for my badge, because obviously I can't protect myself, I can't protect my partners, and I can't protect the community. And
it's an absurd thing to think. It's even worse to say it in a public setting to law enforcement officers. And how did that affect your emotional and mental health?
Well, you know, I was already struggling. I can't say I knew if I had processed the shooting yet, because I think you have to physically heal before you can really start to take on the psychological side and the emotional side of the shooting. But when one of my sergeants, a good friend of mine, he just was shaking his head one day, and I'm like, what's up? And he's like, you're going to get mad. And that's when he told me that. And the curse words started flying. I won't throw those out on your radio, but one of them starts with an F and M, and the other one starts with an F. And there was a lot of those flying out of my mouth, and it was upset. Because at the same time, I had been asking the captain, hey, where are we at with the shooting review board? I just need to hear that I'm clear. And after asking that 10 times in the midst of all this, nice guy, and he just kept saying, you know you're okay. And after about 8 months, I said, you know what, Captain? I don't know I'm okay. I don't know why, but I'm telling you right now, you guys need to give me an answer. I've been cleared by the grand jury. Why would my own agency not give me an answer? And then by that time, the sheriff had already made his comments. And shortly after that, I did have a blow up. I'm not proud of it, not ashamed of it. I was sitting in a room that had the camera download at the time. I was downloading cameras for all the deputies on light duty, and happened to glance over, and I see an award sheet, and it says Darren Kiesling. Yeah, and it gives all the names of the people giving awards for my shooting. And I was really upset because my partner wasn't on there. You know, 2 days on her own, risking her life to protect what she thought was a dead cop. I wasn't really mad that I had gotten a Purple Heart, and I was like, okay, fair enough. I mean, I physically earned it, but they use the word victim, and Randy, it's unreasonable, but it upset me. I don't know why, right, but calling me a victim really bothered me. And we had another deputy a while back who had gotten shot somebody with a single shot, and they had a lighter gun, and they got a big award. I didn't need a big award. I just didn't need to be treated like a victim, and I didn't need to be treated like I was. And somebody asked me what was up, and I was like, you know what, just give me a little time to calm down. And they kept prodding me, and I just blew up on a 5 to 10 minute tirade of everything I was feeling. And by the time I was done, there was about 15 deputies surrounding me and sergeants, and that sent my career on a hell of a downward spiral after that.
You were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, fast forwarding, ultimately they sent me to the main office, and then they asked me to go to psychological evaluation or a fitness for duty evaluation. And I joked and I said, that's because of the blow-up, right? And they're like, nope, this is standard. And I would later find out that I failed it. They only told me verbally over the phone. The doctor never gave a report. And it took the doctor another 8 months to do a written report. And when I see that written report, I would find out that the person that wrote up the referral for that from our office, I don't know if it was purposely set up to fail, but I was going to fail that psychological no matter what based on that information. And I share all of that in my book, by the way. I don't hide any of it. So it's not like I'm embarrassed about the information. I just couldn't believe I was set up. And they said I had narcissism and histrionics, and I believed it for about 10 minutes, and then I calmed down and went to see a doctor, a therapist, and she diagnosed me with PTSD and started working towards it. You know, I have a fight ready to come with the agency, but at the same time, I needed to get better. I hadn't processed the shooting. I'm dealing with all this pressure internally, and I need to get better. So I went to that, and in the midst of that, my attorney set up another psychological with a specialist in PTSD, and without hesitation, he said it was PTSD. He said police officers test these tests different before they're a cop and they're after they're a cop. It tests different. They said once you're involved in a traumatic incident, you test different. And then it became a battle of which doctor thought the other one was more irresponsible.
So the politics of this played a huge role in
more than I could have ever imagine, Randy. I had no clue that somebody could really do this to a police officer. I had told one of my undersheriffs as they were pressuring me before they eventually forced me onto medical leave again because they thought I was getting everybody riled up. But we sat there one day, and I sat there with my weekly meeting with the undersheriff. By this time, they had put me in the crime lab, which is in the basement, because they thought I was riling everybody up. The truth was my lawyer said, don't talk to anybody about the case, and since if you knew me, I'll tell you anything. And so the fact that I wasn't telling people was getting them suspicious. So one day we're sitting in there, and I looked at my undersheriff, and I said, you know what? It always bothered me to think that an agency administration could drive a police officer crazy enough to eat their gun. And I said, now, I'm not suicidal. And in the midst of all this, I'd already lost a good friend of mine to suicide. I said, but, and I won't be hurting myself. I just want you to know, I understand now. An agency literally can drive an officer that crazy, as we've actually seen with some incidences recently.
Let's stop there just for a moment, because this is a really important point. I on this program and in my writing and speaking, I talk about post-traumatic stress injury a great deal. I talk about law enforcement suicide and the epidemic that it has become. And this is the reality that of any point that we could talk about today, it is the administrations of these law enforcement agencies that play a direct role in the emotional and mental health of their officers, whether or not they are involved in a critical incident.
I agree, 100%.
And the fact that you received such shoddy treatment at the hands of your law enforcement administration, without a shadow of a doubt, played a major role in exacerbating your traumatic stress and led to further problems down the road that lasted for years.
Oh, 100% agree. Years, like 13 years. Odd number, I know. But, you know, when I went to see now-retired Gordy Dodge, who was the specialist, when he sat me down, he goes, well, I know your therapist already said it, but I will officially diagnose you with PTSD. And he goes, I believe it's agency-induced PTSD. Oh, and then he kind of...
I like that phrase. I've never heard that phrase before.
and then he smirked at me, and he goes, I'm not going to write that down, though, because I don't want it to cause you more problems. And, of course, I'm in full fight mode, so I'm like, oh, write it down. If it's the truth, write it down. So he just wrote it in a way, kind of what you just said, where it's really the agency's reaction and lack of reaction have exacerbated it and made it worse. So I would have rather had him write it down the other way, but he was looking out for me. We're in the midst of the fight. Now I'm being treated as if I'm being punished, so my lawyer's got a good angle. We go back and forth. Of course, they say, nope, you weren't punished. You were just put on medical leave. And we were getting ready to do a strategy one day. And I remember looking at her. And Randy, there's nothing in my life, as I think I made clear in writing the first part of the book, there's nothing I've wanted more than to be a police officer. And every day I worked as a cop, I'm one of those few cops that truly loved going to work every day. And so when I looked out that window at that restaurant, I finally looked at her and I said, I don't know, what if I don't want to do this anymore? And it was hard for me to get it out, but she was there to help me, and she went and approached him. We were already gearing up for the fight. We were going to do through the grievances in Minnesota, and I'm sure other states, you have to go through the union grievance process because of the contracts. And in the midst of it, she said, well, let me approach the county. And the sheriff had already had a settlement offer ready. I'm not going to say that they were planning on this. I'm not going to say that they weren't. I don't honestly know, but all I know is that she called me immediately and said they already had a settlement offer ready.
Yeah, they were ready to write you off and get you the hell out of there.
You know, and we didn't cover it earlier, and I believe a lot of people say, well, why do you think that happened? They announced for some reason between the ambulance and the sheriff, the information got flipped, and it was that I shot after being shot. And so they released that to the media, interestingly enough, which made the media leave me alone. And once the so then they decided to actually investigate the shooting themselves, which, you know, is just not smart. And there were some people investigating. They actually got in arguments with supervisors because they knew we shouldn't be on this case. And so it almost felt like they were trying to backtrack. that's how it felt. I can't say how it was, but that's how it felt on my end. And so, yeah, and so then you fast forward, it was just a downhill spiral for my side and really for what they, I think they'd hoped what was going to happen. It just kept going negative and negative and negative. And it resulted in a hell of a next 10 years or more for me.
How did you regain your emotional stability and mental health?
Well, first I want to say thank you for using the word emotional. In the writing of my book and talking about PTSD, I really wanted to focus on the emotional side. I don't believe it's, even though it may be categorized as psychological, and for any officer that happens to be listening or families of them, it's an emotional process. And I think that's why we respond so powerfully, because it is emotional. But, you know, I started working as a karaoke DJ and drinking every night, so I didn't handle it the right way. Years and years of liver abuse and bad choices and partying and just drinking and driving and just doing all those things that I was against before, except for drugs. I didn't touch that. Eventually, I got asked to speak to a sheriff's association and about the shooting, and I'm a hypnotist now. So they wanted to kind of combine them, and it was a horrible speaking event, and it was so disorganized because the story, as you can tell, is so vast. And ultimately, a friend of mine said, write it down, organize it. And as I wrote it down more and I got it more organized in my head, I started feeling better. I get angrier, but then feel better. And then once that kind of looked like, hey, maybe this would be a book, I don't know. And then I had a couple people read it and they said, throw some fun stories in. And then I had enjoyed, because I'd stayed away from anything law enforcement, I started enjoying feeling about remembering being a cop. And by the time I got it finished and finally published here recently, I had an ending that was fluff, and I knew it was fluff. And I sat there in May, just before the 13th anniversary, and I knew what needed to happen. There are three or four people that I specifically was holding a grudge and anger on. And it was a legitimate grudge and anger, and I finally needed to forgive. And I wasn't ready until that May date came, and I publicly announced my forgiveness, whether anybody understood anyway. And Randy, I cried for an hour, and ever since then, man, feel great. It's weird.
The book that Dustin is talking about is called 1088, Officer Down, the story of an officer-involved shooting, the politics involved, and the survival of the PTSD that resulted from it all. Where is this book available, Dustin?
We got it on Amazon.com, and then also BN.com, which is Barnes & Noble's, or they can go right to the book's website, which would be 10-88officerdown.com. Any of them, there's a little preview video for it, or a preview copies on my webpage or on Amazon to check it out. But I think that people reading and understanding inspiration will be helpful. And I'm told it's a good read, and I think it's a good read.
Well, I've read it, and I think it's a good read. So give me that website again, 1088.
So it's 10-88officerdown.com. There's no exclamation point in that because the web wouldn't allow it. And it's got a little book trailer, like a little movie trailer on there. And interesting to note, almost all the pictures on the book trailer are actually real.
Well, you know what? Your story needs to be told. I highly recommend the read. And also, the lessons are universal. And this is what I would hope that law enforcement leaders would read your book and learn from it. How to use empathy and compassion and understanding when dealing with officers who have been involved in such intense critical incidents. And I want to thank you for being on the show.
I appreciate you for having me here, Ray.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those men and women of the American law enforcement field who have given their lives in the line of duty. Unfortunately, this week I have three names to read. The first is Detective Kristen Hearn of the Polk County Police Department in Georgia. Detective Kristen Hearn was shot and killed as she and another officer responded to reports of a stolen vehicle at the intersection of Highway 100 and Santa Claus Road. As the officers arrived at the location, they were ambushed by a male subject. Detective Hearn, who was not wearing a vest, was fatally wounded. The second officer was struck in his vest and was wounded. A female subject was taken into custody at the scene. The male subject fled the scene but was arrested a short time later after a massive manhunt and charged with murder. Detective Hearn had served with the Polk County Sheriff's Office for 5 years. She survived by a husband and 3-year-old child. D. Kristen Hearn, Polk County Police Department, Georgia. End of watch, Friday, September 29th, 2017. Corporal Michael Paul Middlebrook of the Lafayette Police Department in Louisiana. Corporal Michael Middlebrook was shot and killed while responding to a shooting at a convenience store near the intersection of Moss Street and Van Buren at approximately 10 p.m. The call was originally dispatched as a person with a gun, but was upgraded to a shooting. As Corporal Middlebrook arrived on the scene, a male subject opened fire on him, engaging him in a shootout. Corporal Middlebrook was fatally wounded during the exchange. The man fled the scene but was later arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Corporal Middlebrook had served with the Lafayette Police Department for 9 years. He survived by his wife, 3-year-old daughter, and 2 young stepdaughters. Corporal Michael Paul Middlebrook, Lafayette Police Department, end of watch, Sunday, October 1st, 2017. The third officer I want to read was murdered while in the crowd at the concert in the worst attack mass shooting in the history of our country. He was a Las Vegas Metropolitan Police officer, a good man, a man who stood for the values of what law enforcement is all about, and in fact even wrote a book about it. His name is Officer Charleston Hartfield. There's no solace to this other than we know Charles, and he was probably doing his best to make sure others were safe and being helped. He was just so special, he's going to be missed by many. In the statement by the police department, this is what they said. This incident on the Las Vegas Strip has devastated families and friends of victims in this terrible attack. The LVMPD is no different, and our Metro family mourns the loss of an officer. We have employees whose family members have suffered significant injury. Those families are asking for privacy during this tough time as they process and move forward through this event. May they all rest in peace. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network.